imagine, like, I don't know, some of you are musicians, some of you are artists, you make drawings, you make paintings, you know, these are the things. As creative founders, you have many creative outlets, right? Maybe you write, you do poetry, right? And some of that poetry might be online, right? You might have put it on LiveJournal a long time ago when you were younger or whatever. Like, what if that's stuff inside of ChatGPT? Like, how do you feel about that? But it seems like a very colonialist, you know, look at all of this stuff. This is mine now, and I'm going to go and make, you know, all, like, this cool thing out of it. Like, what do you mean it's yours? How is the sum of humanity's creative output belonging to anyone except the people that created that output? One of the things that I wouldn't necessarily do local is your founding team. Like, why does it have to be your neighbor that you've known for 10 years, who's like your friend and you happen to have kind of a good relationship with them, as opposed to convincing the head of products at Meta to become your co-founder? Like, why not?
Welcome to Founder Journeys. This podcast is showcasing quick and high-impact conversations about the world of entrepreneurship. In each episode, we speak with founders and investors on specific subjects to inspire current and future entrepreneurs. Join our host, Catherine Lockhart, CEO of Propel, as we build a thriving and sustainable tech community together.
Hi, everybody. My name is Catherine Lockhart. I'm your host of Founder Journeys. Today, I am so excited to introduce Sean Power. Sean is a multiple-time startup founder, Indigenous executive. He loves entertainment, AI, data, gaming. He's an internationally published author. He's been through our program at Propel a couple of times. He's currently the co-founder and CEO of Soms AI and part-time executive and entrepreneur in residence at the Indigenous Center for Cumulative Effect. And my favorite, he's a brand new board member at Propel. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks, Catherine.
I'm super, super excited to have you here and most of all share, get some of your thoughts out to our Atlantic Canadian founders. So welcome.
Thanks. I appreciate it. It's really nice to be here. I'm honored that you asked me to join your board. I've certainly been in your shoes trying to find board members that, you know, hopefully aren't going to be more of a pain in the butt than you're hoping that they will be. It was really nice that you asked me. And depending on how well this podcast goes, it'll, like, you know, determine whether or not it'll be a pain in the ass in our next board meeting or not.
Great. Here's a test for me then. It was a good first board meeting though, I have to say. I was just delighted. So I think we have found a great new crew of board members at Propel. Sean, I want to start off just to give the audience a current flavor of where your brain space is a lot these days. Can you tell us about your current startup, Soms AI, and a little bit about it and what excites you most about it?
Yeah. So thanks for asking. Hi, audience. I won't bore you too much with, like, oh, well, look at what I'm doing. I did X, Y, and Z. and I'll try and put this conversation in a headspace of things that we've been doing at our company, which is teaching a lot. I think, like, many of us are working on kind of tip of the wave startups where we have to kind of teach new ways of being and ways of thinking for different industries. And in our case, we're in the AI space. And the thing that we're teaching really is things revolving around data provenance. And so you all have used ChatGPT, right? And, you know, when you get cool answers, it sure would be nice to know, where's that answer coming from? Right? Like, is it coming from an Ernest Hemingway novel? Is, you know, are the flourishes coming from some great poet? Or are we actually, you know, copying, pasting something that was plagiarized from, you know, some blog post from 2003? Sure, it would be nice to know those things. We're in the music space. We do AI, like generative AI for the, like, the enterprise music industry. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that really sets us apart is that we've created this attribution algorithm. And what this attribution algorithm does is that it's kind of like, you know, the citations needed part of Wikipedia. We allow our customers, we have technology that lets them be able to understand provenance, mm-hmm. where the inputs came from. And so because we're training our models exclusively on our customer data, mm-hmm. and our customer data are the rights holders of music, of large, huge catalogs of music. Mm-hmm. Not only do they have kind of the rights to be able to use that music, so we're already kind of doing one step further than a company that may have trained on all of copyrighted content. But secondly, we mm-hmm. can, you know, for every generation, for every output, there's this associated attribution report, this ledger, if you want, of where the output was influenced by in the inputs. And that looks, it turns out, eerily similar to royalty reports that the music wow. industry has been getting for the last 100 years. And so, you know, audience, as I said, I'll talk a little bit about, you know, what are some of the things that are happening in the AI space. And so this whole concept that you can't do provenance, mm-hmm. that some of the big founders in the AI space have been saying, is a lie. It's mm-hmm. an outright lie. And it's like a lie that's incentivized by not wanting to show that you may have been training on copyrighted content, which might put you in hot water.
Right.
And so what we do at, you know, at SOMS is we kind of like address all of that, and we do it in the music space. It seems like a great beachhead, and we're all musicians, and, you know, we kind of love the work, but we also think it's important. What we're doing is important from an industry perspective.
So many questions. I'm going to go right off script right away, Sean. So you, if I understand this correctly, you are looking at fundamentally how AI and the music industry have been interacting and taking it up to a very authentic level and controlling the source of the inputs that feed the algorithms and the industry itself, sort of the core mechanics of the music industry, and taking the integrity up a level so you understand those inputs. Am I saying that back to you at least remotely correctly?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, like, you know, listeners are gonna feel like, wow, you nailed it. Exactly. And I, you know, my thought is that, like, I use the term beachhead, mm-hmm. right? We are musicians through and through. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing is applicable to all of AI, to text,
yeah.
to video.
Yeah.
To images, to pharmaceuticals who use images and a combination of images and text and so on. And there are so many use cases for provenance. Mm-hmm. And we just think, like, that focus is really, really important. Mm-hmm. Being able to prove that in a market, you know, in one vertical, that there is indeed customer need and those customers are, you know, that the underlying economics make sense, yeah. we think it's really important to focus. So instead of, like, you know, trying to kind of approach all of the verticals at the same time, which we want to do and we thought of doing, we thought that because we're in such a nascent space, it would be prudent, especially right. from a cap table perspective, mm-hmm. to hyper-focus, knock that out of the park,
yeah.
and then start thinking about our broader strategy.
Yeah. Broader applications. Where can you take this new? It almost sounds like you are looking at AI with this ethical lens and say, let's do this properly in the music space and then repeat the model in the next vertical.
Ethical is a weird word, right? Like, I have, like, this shirt behind me that says decolonize AI. Oh. And I think, like, there's, like, a very colonialist mindset to yeah. taking. Like, imagine, like, I don't know, some of you are musicians, some of you are artists, you make drawings, you make paintings, you know, these are the things. As creative founders, you have many creative outlets, right? Maybe you write, mm-hmm. you do poetry, mm-hmm. right? And some of that poetry might be online, right? Yeah. You might have put it on LiveJournal a long time ago when you were younger or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, what if that's stuff inside of ChatGPT? Like, how do you feel about that? Mm-hmm. And, like, how do you feel about the notion that ChatGPT might be referencing your poetry 100,000 times a day? Mm-hmm. I mean, you probably want to know that, number yep. one.
And probably and don't number, currently.
Right? And, like, but number two, that's messed up.
Yeah.
The fact that there's a very real chance that this situation that I just described is happening is messed up. I don't know about ethics or whatever, but it seems like a very colonialist, you know, look at all of this stuff. This is mine now. And I'm going to go and make, you know, all, like this cool thing out of it. Like, what do you mean it's yours? Right. Yeah. Like, how is the sum of humanity's creative output belonging to anyone except the people that created that output?
Right.
I don't know that that's ethical, but it sure feels like a very colonialist attitude to me. And, you know, Indigenous people and people of color, people like, you know, there are people all around the world who have gone through these kind of colonialist attitudes in very real, very physical ways. And I think that this is just playing itself out in a digital space.
And I love that you and your team are tackling it head on with clarity. So thank you for doing that. It may end up in an ethical discussion about how do we capture this data and use it productively in society? Because to your point, grabbing it and assuming that it belongs to the public without that full transparency, how do we feel about that? I love that question, that engagement of any customer, any founder that's listening might go, oh, right. I don't think I'm okay with that. Or I do think I'm okay with that. Whatever their answer is fine. But I love that you're tackling that head on. And with all the questions that are circling around the world about how do we govern AI? How do we, are we scared of it? Are we excited about it? And having founders tackle a specific vertical and prove that it can be done in a very clean, transparent way with providence, as you said, I love that you guys are tackling that. So thank you for taking on a big challenge that I think a lot of the world doesn't yet know they have. And I just want to pull out a point there, Sean, because for founders listening, and Sean, you've run multiple companies and grown multiple companies, founders are often on the cutting edge of change and excited about opportunities, and they're not often scared of hard stuff, complexities. They see this opportunity. So for founders listening, I think what we're seeing in Sean and the work that he and his team are doing is that trailblazing, groundbreaking. Can we change the way that the world works by taking this problem head on? So I think that's a very, very important source of inspiration for those founders listening. Just by understanding the problem that you are solving with Psalms AI.
Thanks, Catherine. I am one of four founders. There's such an equal split of influence that we all have on the direction of our company. Mm-hmm. We've built such an amazing team. Matt Adell, who, like, for the electronic music heads in the audience, will know certainly the company that he was a CEO of for, I think it was 4 or 5 years that he sold, called Beatport.com. Mm-hmm. You know, he's sold a company after that to Native Instruments. Before that, he was a head of products at Napster when Napster was legal and paying people. And then before that, he was at Music Now. They sold Music Now, and he's like a, you know, a music tech lifer that's been working on things surrounding license and provenance and all of that stuff his entire mm-hmm. career. And my two co-founders get SoCan checks, right? Mm-hmm. What that means is that they are musicians that have released albums that have sales, which mm-hmm. through those sales, they get royalties as a result of the work that they've done.
Right.
Right. We are musicians, we are music tech lifers, and we are citizens concerned about data provenance through and through. It's not just like a Sean Power thing. I just happen to have the title of CEO, and sometimes people think like, oh, well, that's the important person. Frankly, every single member of our founding team has had an outsized impact in the direction of our company. And that's because my co-founders are amazing and live this. We are incentivized mm-hmm. by bringing this change to the space.
Now, a burning question that I know our audience has, you're a musician, what do you do music-wise?
Oh, well, that's a long story that's very boring and not worth getting into. I appreciate you appealing to flattery and vanity, but I make music. I've been involved in music for some time.
Okay.
I have a SoundCloud under my name, and I mostly make music for myself and my friends.
I love it. Okay. Because everyone was wondering, I was wondering, and now we're excited to know. Thank you for sharing. Let me switch gears and take you into a more market-focused conversation. We're sitting in the middle. It's April 2024. It's a tough market from a capital perspective if you're a founder. You have grown different companies over the years, Sean. I know you're well-versed in how to grow a company, how to raise capital. Some of them have exited as well. Can you just talk about the differences that you have seen over your founder journey and what it's like today in growing Somms AI? What is the market like today? And you've seen these differences. So I really want you to feel free to compare and contrast that journey from a founder lens so that our founders can learn from that.
From a market perspective, we're finding that the largest companies in the music space are very enthusiastic and are very optimistic about this technology. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of bullshit being thrown around that, like, you know, it's doom and gloom at the large companies. And look, we speak to the largest, you know, the biggest of the big mm-hmm. in music literally every day. Mm-hmm. And all we are getting from them is enthusiasm and that enthusiasm is tied to working with AI properly, right? Like their customers are the musicians that we all listen to. That's their customer base, right? And like as a business, you never want to burn your customers, right? It's actually completely the opposite. You want to set them up for success. Mm-hmm. You know, the success of their customers is the success of them as companies. And so I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm around AI, a lot of enthusiasm around the messages that we're bringing. Mm-hmm. So that's been really interesting from a market perspective. I think like mm-hmm. something that seems more interesting is that I'm less inclined to believe media narratives on AI the more I speak to our customers, because it mm-hmm. seems like there's this disconnect between the large enterprise companies and what they're telling us and what they're showing us through opening their pocketbooks, mm-hmm. The ways that they're talking about approaching AI, which mm-hmm. seems really, really like, frankly, good, like measured,
yeah.
Slow but curious while taking into account their customers that are so important, right? Mm-hmm. And like the media narratives that they're being painted seem at odds with what we're seeing in the market. The VC market, the venture capital market itself it's a really, really difficult market, like a venture capital market. And one of the most important lessons that we've learned is that hyper-local neighborhood VCs is the thing that has worked for us. Like I would hit Mr. Rogers way before I would hit the, you know, A-tier, S-tier celebrities in Hollywood. Because Mr. Rogers is just right around the corner, right? Yeah. He's the neighborhood nice person that understands the neighborhood, maybe knows me, has seen kind of like my growth over the last 10 years and so on. So founders, to be very, very clear, what I mean by that is if you have people in your immediate circle who are close to you regionally, who are close to you as people of color, who are close to you as the gender that you identify with, and have venture capital funds that support local, that support minorities, that support minority founders in all of the beautiful different ways that minorities are minorities. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that I would focus on. Mm-hmm. The people that are right in your lanes, whose stated mandate is to support you. I think that the generalist VC firms, certainly when we were raising, were for a whole variety of reasons, over capacity and not willing to take the kinds of bets that they were taking in the past. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that this information will be relevant, let's say, maybe even 3 months from now. But today, I believe this to be true.
And there's some lessons in there as you've articulated, Sean, but I'm going to repeat a couple of really important points because founders, that's critical. The Mr. Rogers of the neighborhood, or Mr. and Mrs. Rogers, or whoever it is that you most identify with, find that hyper local neighborhood VC who is mandated to invest in the space that you identify with. That is critical. We could put that on a t-shirt. And you said, who have known me over the last 10 years? So I don't want to downplay, Sean, the relationships that you have built over time and getting in those and how those relationships have showed up for you in one startup after another. And the importance of, and at Propel, as you know, we see very early stage startups. So there are relationships with investors, be it Sometimes there's non-dilutive funding and they're building relationships within different government organizations, with angel investors, with venture capital investors. Sometimes they're very, very new. But the importance of that authentic relationship entered with transparency, building up that community in a very deliberate way, sounds like your presence in the community has been part of where the success of your current company is, because those relationships have been very, very meaningful and over time. And they didn't happen overnight. Would that be fair? They didn't happen overnight?
Yeah, I think it's fair. I think there are a variety of reasons, and the privilege that I have, having been working in technology startups since 2005, mm-hmm. In having been a part of growing some ecosystems from maybe next to nothing, a part of, not being the reason the ecosystem built, but like being a small cog in the wheel of Montreal, for example. Mm-hmm. But I think that many folks in Montreal would agree that I was a cog in the wheel of helping Montreal become this kind of powerhouse of startups that it is today. And kind of like my willingness to do whatever it is that I can to help the East Coast as well. Certainly, I think that played a part in many of the discussions that I had with venture capitalists over the course of the last few months. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, and first-time founders, you're not going to marry someone on your first date. You know, it's insane to think that like that would be appropriate. And it takes a long time. Like, I think like earliest, most people marry earliest, I don't know, 5-6 months after meeting someone. Mm-hmm. Many people wait a couple of years, and there are a lot of comparables when we completely remove sexuality from the whole dating thing and we just look at the process of dating. There are a lot of comparables, right? And I think like, because dating at a fundamental level is interpersonal, and I mm-hmm. think the venture capitalism and the process of venture capitalism at a fundamental level is interpersonal, mm-hmm. but we remove the sexuality and we add financial motivations instead. Right. That's like in that layer, I think, is like a critical component to venture capitalism. And I think that one of the things that I have the benefit of just by being around for a while is just having like a really strong network and having had relationships that have grown for a long time. And so therefore, I think that gives me the ability to have people who are willing to take my call maybe more quickly than others. But for the first time mm-hmm. founders, especially, I think that like, you know, being memorable and also being kind of relentless and top of mind while skating kind of like that fine razor's edge of not being too intense, yep. while on the same time being informative, is an art that makes one a good or a bad CEO. You can skate that line. Yep. If you're like, you know, in the inbox of a CEO once a month and you tell them something interesting, they'll be much more likely to take your call.
What you just shared, Sean, that thought I think is also is really, really important, being memorable. That's how, you know, we work at Propel, our whole team. Every call we have, less about us being memorable, but more about proper impact, proper value add to the individuals we're working with. And in our case, it's primarily founders. But no calls that we take on Zoom should be useless, should be a waste of anyone's time. They should add value, significant value, as much as possible that day, which requires thoughtfulness, preparation. And to your point, if you're going to reach out to a venture capital to start building that important relationship, where at the end of the day, you're looking for an appropriate financial transaction, do it with thoughtfulness, meaning be memorable. I love that. I love that a lot.
There's this Startup Fest video that Startup Fest put out on the Startup Fest account, YouTube mm-hmm. account, by Randy Smerick, mm-hmm. called Build to Be Bought. And it's the number 2, capital letter B together, Build to Be Bought.
Okay.
And it's Randy's overview of how venture capitalism really works. And I actually took that presentation and gave it to my multiple exit co-founders on the first day that we all met in person post-funding. Wow. And I did the presentation and I went through it kind of again to remind all of us, we have venture capital funding. What does it mean? And I think like knowing and internalizing the lessons that Randy teaches us through yep. that presentation is critical to understanding, well, what should you be saying to a VC? And why are you even talking to a VC in the first place?
Every founder's journey is unique, And if you need help taking the next step in yours, contact us at info@propelict.com to go further, faster.
That's something that I think in Atlantic Canada, anywhere, but our focus is Atlantic Canada. Understanding if VC is your path or not is half the battle sometimes. And we meet a lot of early stage founders at Propel who think, I'm a founder, therefore I must raise venture capital. And if you don't truly understand how a venture capital firm is structured, how they're set up, how they have LPs with a specific investment thesis that govern how they write those checks, and if you don't fall into their thesis, they're never going to write you a check. And it has nothing to do with you personally. They just can't. So we do a lot of education with our Propel founders around what the VC industry is all about. So that clarity is there. So they're spending their time as wisely as possible. And in today's market, making sure they understand there are other options. Our favorite being customer revenue, of course, spending your time and energy in the market, figuring out, is there a problem I can solve here that someone is willing to pay for? And it's not your mom, because you can't scale her. She can be your supporter and cheerleader, but we need to find a market niche. So if you can generate customer revenue with some of those early adopters, that's a fantastic way to spend your time and energy to develop that early traction. And yes, maybe you are venture backable, but establishing that early traction is very key, I think, to developing those trusted venture capital relationships in the first place.
Catherine, I have a question for you.
I'm ready.
So there's this concept called team and dream raises.
Okay.
And you know, the team and dream raises, you put together a world-class team, you relentlessly learn to clearly articulate your dream, AKA everyone, your vision.
Yeah.
I think Randy, in mentoring me, kind of one of the things that he, you know, that I think that he believed that I needed to do the most work on, and we spent a lot of work doing, is articulating vision. Mm-hmm. And I'm a convert. I'm a huge believer that articulating vision clearly and contextually can make the difference between millions of dollars in your bank account or not. Mm-hmm. Now, in a team and dream raise, some believe that having customer traction is the opposite of what you should be doing for a team and dream raise, because customer traction forces you to have metrics. And by having metrics, you no longer live in the dream world. And so the team and dream raise that I hear is usually stage dependent, right? That team and dream at the seed level is much more difficult than team and dream at the pre-seed level.
Right.
And getting like a $250K check for team and dream is much easier than getting a $2 million check for team and dream. I'm not saying that the $2 million team and dream check is impossible, but I believe that like it's much more likely to be able to close kind of like, you know, one or two or a few kind of 250K. And I'm using that number specifically because that's like squarely in the lane of many pre-seed funders. And so I just wonder what you think of like, you know, the idea that fundraising against metrics can actually be detrimental to fundraising.
Gosh, Sean, you're going to break my brain. I think it's accurate what you've said. It would be more challenging for a team and dream raise later on at the seed stage level. Sometimes you could imagine a team and dream raise at the earlier stage, so pre-seed, almost angel level. And some investors have sworn by betting on the founder who has a big dream, if you will. So they don't fully understand the complexities of a market or the business model, but they believe in the founder who can articulate, to your point, a vision with clarity, with conviction. The how are they going to execute is not yet known, but there's a belief in that founder. So I think a lot of people have done very well betting on a founder. And I would akin that to how you've articulated it, the team and dream. I would challenge in today's market, people are writing fewer checks based on betting on the founder without some early indication of market traction. And I only observe that because the other hat I get to wear is with the Women's Equity Lab. We get to see other founders, women and women identifying founders at that angel level, and the appetite that we get to see working with other investors with no traction is rare. It's rarer than I would like it to be. So I wonder about today's market. I love the thought challenge of, do metrics get in the way of raising? And I wonder if they're more important than ever in today's market. Maybe not important, but leaned on.
I think, like, you know, in a team and dream raise, a team better be extremely compelling.
Yes.
And the dream better be even more so.
Yep.
Right. And I think that the people who can do a team and dream raise know that they have the team. Like, mm-hmm. if you know you have it, mm-hmm. you're, and like other people are telling you consistently, holy crow, mm-hmm. you did what? You have yep. whom? Yep. I think, like, that's when you start having kind of the team. And then the onus is on kind of like the founder to be able to articulate the right dream.
Yeah. Fair. And with those founders, that dream team would have the reputation of likely multiple time founder. They would all probably stand on their own as individuals. And then it's in your case, 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 10, not 4. There's sort of a beautiful compounding effect that people would love to bet on. I think if you can combine, I think the strength of that team could certainly persuade an investor to lean on that team and dream approach instead of pure metrics. If it's a new founder, new relationship, pre-seed or even angel level, I think metrics are going to be required, building that reputation and some demonstration that they can execute. Because for unknown new founders, they've got that work to do.
Which really brings up kind of like this whole notion of crafting from the very beginning, mm-hmm. kind of like having an idea of what the general ballpark might be from a revenue and a fundraise perspective, like whether or not the company that you're building actually needs venture capital funding or not, because
yeah.
you never want to need it, but there are times where you do,
yep.
and it's completely reasonable why. And secondly, if you have to go through the venture capital route, one of the things that I wouldn't necessarily do local is your founding mm-hmm. team. Mm-hmm. Like, why does it have to be your neighbor that you've known for 10 years, who's like your friend and you happen to have kind of a good relationship with them, as opposed to convincing the head of products at Meta
yep.
to become your co-founder? Like, why not?
Yeah.
Why not go and talk to kind of like the former CEO of Instagram mm-hmm. and see whether or not they'll start something with you? Mm-hmm. Why not go out of your comfort zone and talk to the people who can really move the needle in whatever vertical you are, who are really at that top of the pyramid, and kind of work your way down? Why not?
So we need to clearly talk about mindset right now. This is the perfect segue into that. So founders listening, what we just heard Sean say was such a great and important mindset to have, the one of no fear. Why can't you talk to the head of Instagram and try and convince them to be your co-founder? Really recognizing that the opportunities you have as a founder and finding co-founders are up to you. The sky's the limit. You have to be willing to stick your neck out and execute on them and reach for the stars. Like, hesitation is governed by your own fear. So, I mean, Sean, that's such a great example of why not? Like, why not? If founders can ask themselves, why not reach for the stars? And specifically about mindset, it's incredibly important. We see founders coming in to Propel, and they're often very, very excited about a feature in their product. And they just want to show us this feature, and they just want to launch this feature, and then things will be good. But by the time they finish our program, they're obsessed with solving their customer's problem. So they've learned to evolve their mindset to be less deep product focus and more understanding, listening, and responding, listening to the market. What does the data tell them? And very much, you know, we have a saying at Propel, those founders are very, very coachable, that we call them learn-it-alls and not know-it-alls. And throughout, you've had many successes throughout your career, Sean, and have been forever remain very humble in your approach to continual learning. I mean, anyone in this audience can hear your appetite for learning, even though you've already been incredibly successful. Can you talk to us about where did that learn it all attitude approach come from? And also why you might think it's important for a founder to have and hold that mindset always, no matter what they've accomplished?
You know, it starts with my family, like my brother, my mother, my father. So that was kind of like a key thing for our family early on. And so that's kind of like woven in my ways of being as a child. I dreamed for the stars when I put Psalms together. Like, we have an incredible founding team. I still have a crush on my founders. Like, every once in a while when I get on a call with Matt, I'm still like, oh my God, it's Matt Adele. And then I have to like stop. Sean, stop. It's chill. We're just talking about today's sprint. But like, you know, because Matt, I mean, he led one of the sites that I probably spent, like I spent so much money on Beatport. Beatport was like this really important source of electronic music for me. Not necessarily like certainly from a purchasing perspective, but sometimes discovering new artists and all of that stuff. And the thing that's like so interesting about Matt is that like, I did not know about Matt Adele's name, let alone had ever been in the same room with him 14 months ago. And I founded a company with him.
14 months. Let's unpack that, Sean.
14 months ago, right? And it's like, you know, I was introduced to him by someone very close to me that I trust.
Right.
He's, you know, like Charlotte, he's a coach of mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, I choose my coaches very, very seriously. Like, I don't want anybody to be the person who's whispering closely in my ear, making sure that I'm okay. Yeah. You know, Charlotte that, you know, works under you for Propel is, in my opinion, literally one of the best coaches in North America, possibly the world.
Could not agree more. Yep.
Bar none. Yep. And I have like an equally great, but who covers many, many other different aspects. This other coach called Eric Marcouillet, and Eric had done some work with Matt. We got introduced. Matt and I started having some great conversations. And it was through that like the last pillar of what we needed for our company kind of emerge. Mm-hmm. Matt's relationships that run 30 years deep in the music tech space is critical for us to be able to do what we needed to do. Yeah. And so one of the kind of like big achievements that were my first achievements as CEO and founder of the company initially, mm-hmm. I said founder, not co-founder, because I initially founded the company myself first. Yeah. And my biggest task was to find the best team in the world to realize the vision. I don't think that I can bat with the major leaguers if I'm not learning from them. Because mm-hmm. if I'm not learning from them, then I can't get to the all-star game. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, you know, I can't afford to kind of sit in comfortably.
Yeah.
I just can't. I don't think any of us can.
Yeah. If you showed up and knew it all, do you think you would have gotten the dream team?
And you wouldn't have let me in Propel, and we wouldn't have gotten the
Charlotte
amazing...
wouldn't be your buddy. Like, no.
Right.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't have gotten the incredibly important and amazing investment that we received. Like, assumptions are our worst enemies. And it's so cliche. Eric Ries has been saying that since mm-hmm. forever, right? Through when he started this lean startup movement about challenging our assumptions. And, you know, I've just been so lucky to be around folks like Eric, to be mentored by Alistair Kroll and by Randy Smerick, who like they've consistently just destroyed my ego, right? Like the id and ego just destroyed my ego and helped me realize like, you know, I am at my strongest when I'm constantly learning. Mm-hmm. That's when I'm at my best. And I think that like our mentality needs to live in a thirst of learning from our customers and learning from the market and learning from each other as we're building a company. And like, surprise, surprise, like that's very close to some of the grandfather teachings, the Anishinaabe grandfather teachings. They're, you know, kind of like they're major teachings that different communities have in the Canadian Indigenous tapestry. Mm-hmm. And the Anishinaabe talk about the grandfather teachings. And, you know, I think like humility is one of the essential tenets of, you know, the seven grandfather teachings. And I've surrounded myself with people who challenge me and who remind me that, like, you know, there are always new perspectives to learn, but who also help me make decisions. I'm stronger because of Charlotte. I'm stronger because of Eric and Randy and Alistair and Ian and the amazing entrepreneurial women in my life, that some of whom I mentor, some of whom mentor me, the amazing people of color in my life, some of whom mentor me, some of whom I mentor. I've created a support system around my being a founder because I need it.
I love that. Absolutely love that. If anybody takes anything away from this podcast today, it's that mindset. And I wrote it down, Sean, because I like it so much. You said, I am at my strongest when I am constantly learning. And I think you're in a new startup now. You have a brand new top of the notch team surrounding this passionate movement that you folks are tackling together, and you're learning while doing, and you have that support community around you to help you make those decisions. I like that as well. Helping to make those decisions with those experts around you, be it coaches or co-founders or industry experts or venture capital relationships that you have, leaning on them for whatever it is that you need, but with the lens of constantly learning. I think that's so critical. Sean, I want to get to a couple more questions. I want to talk about Atlantic Canada for a second. I know you have a warm spot for Atlantic Canada. You've always been connected to the region, including with your current startup. What do you think the future of Atlantic Canada could look like? And what do you think we need to do to unlock our full potential here? We have, you know, let's call it 800, 1,000 startups here. We have some fantastic venture capital firms. We have a lot of accelerators and incubators supporting this ecosystem. What are your observations about the region?
I mean, this could be an hour long podcast just on that question alone, right? Yeah, and totally. Catherine, I think, like, I really hope that you get to speak about that during podcasts, because I think that your perspective is so critical to be heard. And I just kind of want to recognize and hope that anybody who's listening that happens to be in some kind of, you know, position of authority in the Atlantic region has a chance to be able to talk to you, Catherine, and be able to hear your thoughts, because they're much more important than mine. Oh. And, you know, you've been learning, right, the answer to that question for years now. You are actually one of the experts at that question, not me. My perspective is really simple. I believe that there's incredible talent. There has been. We all know it. There's incredible talent in the East Coast. Mm-hmm. Not many people know this, but one of the nerve centers of AI and music comes out of Dalhousie University.
Oh, cool.
And so there are, again, like, when you're building your dream, sometimes, especially, I feel like if one is on the right path, like Indigenous Canada talks a lot about the creator, whether you believe in whatever it is that you believe, it's like the creator sometimes tells you and shows you that you're on the right path by putting all the right pieces in place, even though it's difficult, you know, these things end up being surmountable. Yeah. I think that, like, you know, we are an Atlantic, we consider ourselves an Atlantic Pan America company with strong ties to the East. Yep. You know, I spend a lot of time in the East. We have venture capital funding that is East Coast based. The most amount of employees that we have are East Coast based. Mm-hmm. And our very first hire was another East Coaster. You know, like, I don't just, like, these aren't just words for me. I believe it, right? Like, we're living.
Oh, you're walking the talk. Yeah.
And so I just think there's incredible talent. And I think what unlocks it is talent teaching talent, is talent bringing people together on land together for events. I think, like, Natasha Dzuga is a person who brought me to the East Coast, and Dan Martel. Between them, they brought me to the East Coast several times, like 10, 15 years ago in my kind of, like, entire relationship with the East Coast started then. And I think that like those kinds of things had a huge impact in Montreal when Alistair and I would bring folks like Heaton Shaw and Brady through Startup Fest. Mm-hmm. When we started Startup Fest, we were bringing, and we, you know, Startup Fest still continues to bring some of the world's best inside of Montreal for hang time. Back when we were doing Startup Fest, like it was a lot more informal. Mm-hmm. You could just like literally chill out with Eric Ries and have like a drink with them and stuff like yeah. that. Those things really work. And then money.
Yeah.
And then money.
And then money. And then money. It's an important part of the puzzle, right? But I appreciate those observations, and not just those observations, but they're factual from your lens. You are leveraging the great talent in Atlantic Canada. Mm-hmm. They are on, you know, part of your growing team, which is exciting. I look forward to seeing Atlantic Canada evolve into its full potential, because we get to see the entrepreneurial appetite at Propel every day. I get to see it with my Women's Equity Lab hat on. I get to see an increasing number of women and women identifying founders at the decision-making table on the co-founder level, which is great. That metric is moving, though the funding flowing into those companies is far, far behind. We got a lot of work to do there. So I'm excited for Atlantic Canada with all our raw materials being talent, ideas, ambition, bringing in the right amount of funding to help realize those dreams and visions and ventures that these folks are tackling. I'm excited to help connect those dots as best as possible. I also know, Sean, that you spend a great deal of your time as a part-time executive with the Indigenous Center for Cumulative Effects. And you have recently secured, is it $25 million in funding?
$20 million.
It's still a big number. Can you just talk about that work, what that work means to you?
We got to help our people.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
How long have you been involved with the organization?
A couple of years now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was called upon by the executive director, Leah Litzkus, and I continue to be called upon by the board to help. Mm-hmm. The thing that's like so important to me these days is just to work smart. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I don't waste time. It's just to work smart. I learned a long time ago that for me and only me, working long ass hours were often a means for me to be able to cope with the fact that sometimes I just didn't know what to do.
Right. Wow.
And I learned a long time ago to let go and to focus on the things that matter, mm-hmm. and to delegate the things that like I can't do, and to be at peace with the things that don't get done.
Would you say you have a good, healthy awareness of what you can't do, and you comfortably delegate that?
It's getting better every day. I think that's a journey, not a destination.
Yep. Yep. I love
that. How about that. You? What would be the answer for you?
I'm getting there. Same. It's a journey, and I'm really owning the fact and leaning into the fact that I can't do it all. And I'm okay with that. And it's a constant balance. But also firmly believe, as you've articulated in working smart, I've been on the side, and I'm sure you have as well. Burning out is not fun. Been there, done that, know what that looks like. The long hours and learning how to channel your energy into things that are adding value to the right parties in your life, be it your family, your friends, your coworkers, the founders you work with, whatever that looks like for you is critical. Mm-hmm. Charlotte says, busy does not equal progress. Just because you're exhausted long days doesn't mean you've got anything done that's helpful. So being really mindful about how you spend that time is key. And I love relinquishing that, like you can't do it all. It's okay. Fully embrace that. And get into the more learning mode instead of I can do it all. I don't have to do it all. That's what great people are for.
Also, don't solo found a company.
Thank you. Let's repeat don't that one. Don't solo.
Don't ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't ever do it.
Don't solo found a company.
I've mentored some incredible people, some incredible women who have been solo founders. And I, oh my gosh, seeing the struggle of the solo founders, I think that they would say that they would never, ever, ever recommend it to anyone.
Yep.
I certainly would.
Yeah. And if I look at Propel's founders from a data perspective, just because we serve over 100 founders a year at this 100 companies a year at this point, we're about 180 plus founders. The ones that do the best have co-founders every time, to your point. It's a tough journey. It takes a village to raise a startup, as we've all heard many times, and doing it with a partner, a co-founder, or a couple, like in Sean, in your case, that's the way to go. Yep. One last question for you, and then sadly, we have to wrap it up. If you were to meet a young person in your life and they said, Sean, I am going to start a company, what advice would you give them?
I mean, stand on the shoulders of giants.
Ooh, I like it.
Convince those giants that you're worth being put on their shoulders. Show them who you are. Make yourself seen, like really seen authentically. And people will respond to that. I know I will.
Fantastic.
Thanks,
I
Catherine.
Love that. That could be put on a t-shirt. Sean, there's a couple of t-shirt quotes here from today, but that stand on the shoulders of giants is a really, really good one. Thank you so much, Sean, for sharing your thoughts with us today. Very much appreciate it. And I'm certain our founders will be re-listening to some of these inspirational moments from you. So thanks for taking the time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Founder Journeys by Propel ICT. Propel ICT is Atlantic Canada's e-accelerator for tech startups. Are you a founder looking to build on sales and marketing skills, reach and engage with the right customers, and ultimately find success? Our coaches are eager and excited to help you and your business go further, faster. To learn more about us and our team, visit propelict.com. Propel ICT, where founders become leaders.